listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the Wisconsin author of a new guide to creativity for girls that aims to walk them through the creative process and learn a little bit about science, too. First, Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin and Republican challenger Leah Vukmir met Saturday in Wausau for their second debate of the campaign. They tackled issues including health care, abortion, immigration, and climate change. It got a bit heated at times. Here's Vukmir attacking Baldwin for not meeting with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh.
And then you come up with this excuse that you called the White House and you tried and 7 or 8 times. Are you that ineffective as a senator that you could not get a opportunity to meet with somebody that is going to be before you to confirm? That is your job, Senator Baldwin.
And here's what Baldwin had to say in response.
We got to clean up a bit here. Leah is lying again. And first of all, the way you make an appointment with a nominee is to go through the nominator, which is the White House. I am among dozens of senators who were denied the chance to meet with him. I don't know if they're going into protection mode, but that is the truth.
J.R. Ross is the editor of WisPolitics.com and attended Saturday night's debate. J.R., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. How you doing?
Good. Well, we wanted to talk to you. I mean, this debate happened on the night of a Brewers playoff game, a UW Badgers game. In some ways, for a big race, this debate was under the radar. Do you feel like it didn't get as much attention as a debate like this usually would?
Honestly, most of the debates we have in Wisconsin don't get the kind of attention like a presidential debate would, where you have millions of eyeballs for a number of reasons. I mean, they're often on weekend nights in October when there are football games going on, other stuff happening. They're just not really attention grabbers. And so really, most people that I talk to around politics, when they watch these debates, they're looking for a gaffe. Is there a big moment that could live on to haunt a candidate? Not really in the media coverage, but in paid media, you know, TV, radio, digital ads that can then be used. But other than that, I mean, they don't really expect these to be game changers in the grand scheme of things, these campaigns.
I know you can't always tell this sort of thing in real time, but are people talking about a moment like that at this debate where, hey, yeah, here's something, somebody just wrote the other side's campaign ad?
No, not from what, you know, looking at social media reaction and talking to campaign, I've not sensed yet that there was something major out of this. It was interesting. The first debate was a week ago today, and in that debate, you know, Leah Vukmir was clearly the more aggressive candidate in that forum, and that's partly to be expected. I mean, she's been down double digits most of the polls that I've seen in the last month. But what was remarkable to people is that Tammy Baldwin seemed a little bit, I don't know if hesitant was the right word or more halting in her speech, but she wasn't as kind of fluid in her responses to Leah. Now, fast forward to this past Saturday, and it was a much different performance from Baldwin, much more smooth, seemed quicker with the responses to Vukmir, who was, again, you know, on a little more aggressive because she's behind. But for being an improved debate performance for Baldwin, for people I talked to, they also didn't see, like, again, that game changer moment that's going to really impact a race where Baldwin has had a significant financial advantage on Leah Vukmir.
A big chunk of time in this debate went into the issue of health care. I understand J.R. Baldwin says she supports, let's start with her, she supports a Medicare for all system. What did she say about that at the debate?
Well, you know, she's talking about, it's not interesting in the grand scheme of things. For Democrats, they've been on the defense about health care for really most of the last 8 or 9 years since the Affordable Care Act, i.e. Obamacare, was approved. This is the first cycle that I can remember in talking to people on both sides of the aisle where Democrats feel like they're on the offensive on health care. So, yes, Tammy Baldwin is talking about Medicare for all, that there's, you know, a better alternative to what we're doing right now. If you add up all that we spend on health care, then maybe there's a different option. She's also hitting Leah Vukmir on a number of things, on pre-existing conditions, on past votes in the legislature. She's trying to portray Vukmir as a kind of a tool of the insurance industry. And, you know, she's got a lot of money behind those ads right now, and we're seeing polls that have Vukmir's numbers upside down with voters. It's just that some of it's working at this point.
And what was Vukmir's case on health care and the Affordable Care Act?
She talked about how that Baldwin's lying about her record, that she would throw herself in front of a truck before she allowed those with pre-existing conditions to lose coverage, stressed that she's a nurse, that she knows the health care industry, that Baldwin's, you know, she calls it Baldwin Care, the Medicare for All plan, that they would basically bankrupt us because it would cost so much for every man, woman, and child in the country. She's trying to push back that Baldwin wants the government to take over your health care and raise those fears that, you know, people had about the Affordable Care Act.
Talking to J.R. Ross from WisPolitics.com, looking at this weekend's debate between incumbent U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin and her Republican challenger, State Senator Leah Vukmir. A really contentious moment came up when it came to immigration. Baldwin reaffirmed her support for comprehensive immigration reform. Vukmir said she wants a wall along the border with Mexico. They also weighed in on Trump administration policies that separated children from families at the border. Here's a listen to both of them, Baldwin followed by Vukmir.
We don't put children in cages like this president has done, and we can't ever look at doing that again. His changes on asylum are despicable. We are a country that welcomes immigrants, and we should always be that country, and we can do much better than this.
Ms. Vukmir?
Well, it's interesting to hear Senator Baldwin talk about how outraged she is about children being separated, and we should be. It's wrong. But where was that outrage, Senator Baldwin, when the same thing was happening under the Obama administration? I never heard from you, never heard a word. You never did anything. But now, because it is President Trump, you want to go on the attack.
And Baldwin, I understand, also raised objections, saying that she had raised this issue under the Obama administration. Can you talk a little more about what we heard on immigration, JR?
You know, that was probably one of Vukmir's memorable lines from the debate Saturday night, where she said that essentially that Senator Baldwin's idea of a border is a line in the dirt, a wink and a nod, that she favored open borders and allowing Mexican gang members to come into the country freely. Obviously, Baldwin didn't agree with that assessment of her position. Also worth noting that in that debate, you know, the president came up quite a bit talking about the border policy, the asylum stuff, separating families at the borders. And toward the end, the panel asked, you know, Baldwin, where do you agree with President Trump? And she talked about renegotiating trade agreements, Buy American provisions. And they asked Vukmir, where do you disagree with Trump? And she said, basically offered nothing, no issues, and said she gives the president an A so far. So it kind of underscores that in this race a little bit, Vukmir is tied somewhat to President Trump. She needs Trump supporters to be energized to come out. And the fact that his polls are upside down aren't really good for her, because she doesn't have an identity outside of the generic GOP ballot right now, in part because of the disparity in ad spending we've seen in favor of Senator Baldwin.
There's been some talk that these midterm elections are very much nationalized as opposed to state and local affairs, in part because of polarization around President Trump. Did you get that sense in this debate, or was there some Wisconsin-specific stuff that went on?
You know, honestly, it's mostly focused on national stuff, and that's what I'm picking up from people, is that the environment is impacting this race. You know, not just the issues that we're talking about or where we're at, but looking at the national environment in terms of the map. You know, Tammy Baldwin's view is being a vulnerable senator going into the 2018 cycle, in part because Trump won Wisconsin 2 years ago. But if you look nationally, the groups are spending money in West Virginia, in Indiana, in Missouri, in North Dakota, Montana, Florida, Tennessee, Arizona, Nevada. We're like number 10 on the list, and that's where you're not seeing like a tsunami of waves coming in or of ads coming in on either side, really. I mean, there's some stuff going on, don't get me wrong, but it's nothing like we've seen in past cycles. We're really a top-tier Senate race. We've kind of fallen off the map a little bit, and that has hampered Vukmir's ability to close the gap with Baldwin at this point.
So a third and final debate scheduled for this Friday at Marquette University. JR, what are you watching for in that one?
Again, you know, is there a big gaffe? Is there something that lives on beyond the debate? I'm going to guess from talking to people that Baldwin will try to keep the same, you know, positions. Vukmir will probably be more aggressive again. But unless there's a big mistake, that's what we'll watch for. Is there something big that kind of lives on beyond Friday? Otherwise, there's not much change in the dynamic or the trajectory of the race. I mean, something that Vukmir could use, for example, is this whole Kavanaugh, the debate about the Brett Kavanaugh nomination that came up during the debate on Saturday. there's talk about that goosing the enthusiasm of conservative voters. That would be a help for Vukmir if they can sustain that energy through Election Day. I also sort of thought that, you know, the Democratic response or some of these groups that are associated with Democrats, the response to the nomination, the confirmation, that might remind rural voters, this is a theory I heard, of what they didn't like about, like, the protests over Act 10. The feeling that, you know, they're not real happy, might be happy in Washington, D.C. with Republicans in charge, but when they see the protest, it makes them somewhat uneasy because there's a cultural divide between where some of these folks are at in rural Wisconsin and what they're seeing going on in D.C. So if that ignites some passions, maybe that helps. But right now, it seems like the trajectory has been that Baldwin is in the lead, and it's a matter of can Vukmir find a way to close that gap. You know, might a very close governor's race or even Walker winning, might that help Vukmir? Things like that they're looking for. But I'd say right now, you know, she needs something that changes the trajectory to help her close the gap through now Election Day.
JR, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime.
J.R. Ross is the editor at WisPolitics.com. We talked to him about Saturday's U.S. Senate debate between Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin and Republican challenger State Senator Leah Vukmir. First, there are a lot of books for adults designed to try to get us to think more creatively and spark our imagination and our inspiration. But when it comes to kids, we tend to assume creativity is just kind of always there. A new book written here in Wisconsin is designed to teach kids about the creative process and that creativity is more than just arts and crafts. Andrea Debink is the lifestyle editor for American Girl magazine and the author of the new book, Spark, A Guide to Ignite the Creativity Inside You. Andrea, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me today.
Well, what led you to want to tackle this, to try to inspire creativity for kids, girls in particular in this case?
Yeah, it was actually inspired a lot by my work with American Girl magazine. I've been the lifestyle editor there for about 9 years, and the bulk of the content I create is creativity focused, so crafts and recipes and that sort of thing. So it really grew out of that experience.
And people might think, well, kids, they're creative. Why do they need a book?
Right. Yeah, you know, I think it really depends on the age of the kid. For me, I create specifically for the middle grade audience, which is kind of that early preteen group. And that's really the age where kids are getting more self-conscious and kind of experiencing more of the inner critic, I think you would call it, when it comes to topics like creativity. So this book is really kind of helping them at that phase in their creative development.
Yeah, there's I've seen studies of big changes. What kind of age are you talking about here?
This book is for 8+.
8+. Okay, yeah. So that's when you start to see in studies interest in science and technology changing, interest in different kinds of arts changing, a lot of different things. So this is kind of a key turning point in some ways.
It is, yep.
So take us through now Spark and how you try to spark that creativity.
Yeah, well, the book really opens with defining creativity, and it was really important for me in the book itself to cast a really broad definition of what creativity is, because I think that's part of the problem is that we often define it in a really narrow way, especially with kids. If they're not artistic or draw or, you know, paint or write, they don't often think they're creative. So from the get-go in the book, I really try to define creativity very broadly to cover a lot of different disciplines. And then after that, I kind of go into the creative process itself through a four-step process that I kind of lay out throughout the book.
Yeah, give us the overview of that process.
Yeah, the overview. So the four main steps that I cover are imagine, make, tinker, finish. And that really is taking kids from the idea phase and then bringing them through kind of with the rough draft phase, the styling or the kind of refining phase, and then finishing it and sending the idea out into the world.
I want to talk about the refining phase because I love you talk about kind of a scientific method for creativity. Can you dig into that a little more?
Right. Yeah. You know, the scientific method is in here if the child is actually dealing with a creative idea that relates to that sort of discipline. But the creative method here for kind of more general creativity has to do with getting feedback and dealing with discouragement and that sort of thing. So from a general perspective, that's what kind of the book goes into.
Talking to Andrea Debink, author of the new book, Spark, A Guide to Ignite the Creativity Inside You, helping to spark and give a little method and inspiration, especially to young girls and help them be creative in different phases of life. And you give some role models early on, women who could inspire creativity. And again, not just, you know, painting and what we think of as art and creativity.
Right. There's a section of the book that deals with women from throughout history, so women in the past, but also women who are still around and creating today. And then I also pulled in some words from women who aren't necessarily famous, but they are out in the world today creating in some capacity. And I thought it was important to have many different women represented in this book, again, to kind of show the broad range of what it means to be creative and the different ways that that can play out in a person's life.
And a piece of the book that I really like is dealing with criticism and discouragement. You talked about the inner critic. There are outer critics, too. Talk about how you you talk to younger girls about getting feedback, getting positive feedback, and how to deal with the less useful stuff.
Right. Yeah. So for the feedback portion of it, I give girls like three different criteria that they should use when evaluating feedback from other people. And the first is really knowing that you don't have to get feedback from everyone, that to be selective about the feedback. Also asking good questions when you're getting feedback about your work, not just is this good, but, you know, questions that could maybe help refine the work a bit. And then the third step would be to decide whether or not to use the feedback, because just because someone makes a comment about the work you're creating doesn't mean you have to use it. And that's a part that's in the book, too. And then as far as the criticism and the discouragement, that would be feedback that comes from people that's not helpful or is mean-spirited. And there's a section in the book that talks about that, too.
And it flips around, too. I mean, it's kind of guidance on how to give good feedback.
Right.
Yeah, can you talk about how we can think of the feedback we might deliver to people, even if we're, you know, 48-year-old males, not just middle school girls?
Right, yeah, there's a section in the book that I call creative critique, and it's really taking the reader through the process of, like you said, giving good feedback on creative work. The first is just really to observe and describe what you're seeing, you know, if you're evaluating someone else's creative work. The second would be seeing the good in it and pulling out its strong points that maybe the creator can build on. The third would be spotting the problems. Not necessarily, I don't like this, but pointing out areas where there might be room to change or grow. And then the fourth would be thinking of solutions to the problems that you just pointed out.
Talk about most of your book is exercises for those four different stages. Can you share one or two of the exercises that somebody might be able to try at home?
Yeah. Let me just look through here quick. There is a couple of pages that I call brain breaks, and those are totally just for fun pages where it's not connected to any sort of specific creative activity. But the brain break, for instance, has pictures of made up animals and birds and flowers and that sorts of things. And then the reader is encouraged to just brainstorm a name for those. And then on the next page, it's kind of the opposite, where we give you a name, like Blairy Blurt Cake is something that's in the book, or a gadget called a Zizzle Zip. And then the reader has to doodle that and kind of come up with, okay, what would this look like if this was a real thing that existed?
And both in your work at American Girl magazine and then in response you've had so far from the book, what kind of things do you hear from girls in this age range when they talk about creativity and maybe things that have helped them re-embrace it?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing I've heard, and this was at some events that I've done for the book's launch, is just an appreciation for encouraging a broader view of creativity, because I've seen all sorts of kids that come to these events, but I think one thing I've heard is kids who didn't necessarily think they were creative, when they see the thing that they like to do, like robotics or solving equations or something in the book, it's helped them realize, oh, I am creative, because, you know, I enjoy things that are in here that I'm actually talking about in relation to creativity.
Yeah, so looking at your book, it sounds like that's the big win for you when you hear that from a kid.
Yep.
I didn't know I was creative, but I am.
Yes, yep.
And we hear often now from the business community a skill, we've talked about this on the show, a skill that they're looking for in employees is creativity, and not necessarily, yeah, we want people to come in and do fabulous portraits for us, but creative thinking. Are you selling this in part to teachers, parents, and kids? This could actually help you in your career down the road.
Absolutely. I honestly wrote this for adults as much as I wrote it for kids. And I've had a lot of adults that have actually read the book and said, you know, I know I'm not in your age group for this book, but I totally love it. And I got a lot of great things out of it. And to be honest, I still get things from this book, because the things that I wrote are things that I need to be reminded of, too. So I think no matter where you're at or what age you are, this could be a helpful book for you.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you find the lessons you've, you know, the creativity you put into making the book inspiring you to try to think creatively now that you're done with it?
I do, absolutely. There are times that I find myself rereading parts of it and thinking, oh, I should probably put that into practice more.
Now, there are probably more parents and teachers listening right now than actual 8-year-olds, I'll be honest with you. So can you leave us with a message for those parents and teachers to not let that creativity go away as the kids hit upper elementary and middle school?
Yeah, I would just, again, as I've said, to encourage their child to have a broader view of creativity and to not be discouraged by things they make not turning out the first time. You know, understanding that creativity is a process and that part of that process is failure and practice and getting better over time.
We'll leave it there. Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Andrea Debink is lifestyle editor for American Girl magazine. She's the author of the new book we've been talking about, Spark, A Guide to Ignite the Creativity Inside You. Love to hear from you. Have you maintained or maybe reignited creativity at some stage in your life? Tell us what you did, how you did it, and how it's working for you. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Be as creative as you want. Now, the American dream and America first are two common phrases we hear in our politics today. They've been used to offer different visions of what the United States is and should be. President Trump has talked about both. Here he is laying out a version of the American dream in his State of the Union address earlier this year.
There has never been a better time to start living the American dream. So to every citizen watching at home tonight, no matter where you've been or where you've come from, this is your time. If you work hard, if you believe in yourself, if you believe in America, then you can dream anything.
And here's Trump affirming his intent to put America first at his inaugural address in 2016.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Both of these terms have changed a lot since they first entered the national conversation. Our next guest has written about where they came from and what the battle over their meaning can tell us about some core principles of American government. Sarah Churchwell is a professor of literature and public understanding of the humanities at the University of London. She's the author of the new book, Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we dig into the history of each of these phrasings, what do we get from stepping back from 2018 and looking back into how these ideas, these principles of American politics originated and evolved?
Well, what I hope is that, you know, a longer view can give us a sense of some of the, exactly that question of evolution, to use the word you just used. And that means that we don't necessarily have to accept received wisdoms and received histories about what these ideas have to mean. And to look back into the past, we can discover that there are layers of meaning in both of these phrases that tells us things about our national identity and the debates that we're having right now, how those mirror and extend the debates we've been having for a long time.
I want to tackle each of these phrases now in turn. And let's start with the American dream. I think people think of the American dream, it's often used in the media as, you know, home ownership, middle class lifestyle. It's economic, it's consumer, and it's stability. Can you talk about the origins of the phrase American dream and some of what it might have meant originally?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the American dream is really where this project started, because I was doing a lot of reading in the cultural history of America in the 1920s and 1930s, which is when the phrase really started to gain traction. And I realized as I was reading about the way that Americans all over the country used it, I mean, this isn't just, you know, in major works of literature or in big political speeches, but in ordinary life, ordinary voices all over the country, in having the debates that we have now about how to secure, you know, prosperity for all and opportunity for all and how to maintain equality and justice. But they were using the phrase the American dream in almost exactly the opposite way that we use it now. So instead of using it to argue for what you were just describing, individual prosperity, individual affluence, ambitions for personal success, you know, what we think of as the rags to riches story, the self-made millionaire, all of that stuff that I think most Americans today, you know, myself included until I did this research, would have said, yeah, that's what we usually mean by the American dream. They were using the American dream in the opposite way to say that with inequality at that time, which was, this is right after the boom of the 1920s and after the Gilded Age of the 1890s, as the phrase started to take hold, they were looking at similar kinds of inequality that we're looking at now. And they said that there was this new thing called multimillionaires, which they looked at sort of as we might look at billionaires or kind of Jeff Bezos level of wealth, right? It's this kind of startling new level of wealth. And they said, if we let people get this kind of private wealth, that will be the end of the American dream, because the American dream is about equality and opportunity for all, not just for the few. And so they were using the American dream to harken back to those, you know, founding principles about liberty, justice, opportunity for all, and indeed equality, and arguing that inequality would destroy those American dreams. And so the American dream was coined, really, to advocate for principles of social justice against free market capitalism. And of course, now it's far more often used the other way around, to argue that free market capitalism is what will enable individuals to rise. But 100 years ago, they were facing exactly the same problem. In fact, to the extent that they coined the expression, the metaphor of the 1% and the 99%, because they were looking at the same inequality. So they also talked about how 1% of the nation was controlling, you know, a vast majority of the wealth, and 99% of the country was left behind. And they said, in order to fight that kind of inequality, we need to figure out how to control capitalism so that we can protect the American dreams of democracy, of equality, and of justice.
Talking to Sarah Churchwell, author of the new book, Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. So when does the American dream flip to mean not exactly the opposite of what you were just talking about, but pretty close?
Mm-hmm. Pretty close, yeah. Well, it takes the opposite side of the debate, right? So there's a debate about whether the country is better off with kind of individual private wealth, individual aspiration, and eventually the argument saying that only totally free market capitalism would enable that kind of aspiration and prosperity, and then the arguments that actually you will do better as a society if you protect collective equality and protect opportunity for all. And so it switched sides in the same, so the debate remained the same, but the American dream switched sides. And that happened after the Second World War. So that happened when consumer capitalism really took off, when the post-war boom took off, and the idea started to spread that post-war prosperity really could be had by all, and that there could be kind of, that the nation could have its cake and eat it, basically, that you could have vast private wealth kind of for everybody. And in particular, that consumerism is what would deliver that. And one of the kind of moments of where we can mark that pivot is when Harry Truman in 1947 said that freedom of enterprise was, you know, kind of an inalienable American right. And a lot of us probably think, I know I did, that the notion of freedom of enterprise as a phrase is much older than that. But it was actually from 1947. And at that point, it helps kind of, I always think of the American dream, as I said, it's about a debate between kind of justice and liberty. And at that point, it started to kind of really tip onto the scales in favor of kind of liberty, questions of individual liberty and individual rights to pursue what you wanted to do, and to be increasingly less concerned with questions of social justice and collective well-being.
Well, let's turn to the other phrase, America First. This was a phrase that President Trump used as Donald Trump in his campaign. And people said, oh, you have to go back and look to its origins in the 1930s and 1940s. Well, you're right. Hold on. It goes back further than that. Can you talk about when America First was first used in America?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a much older phrase. And I think So that earlier period, again, is instructive. It teaches us more about what Americans have been arguing about and why. America First, the earliest traces I've found of it are from the 1880s, actually, as a Republican slogan. Although, of course, as we all know, the Republican Party in the 1880s, you know, is a far cry from the Republican Party today, and the same goes for the Democrats' parties. You know, their identities have shifted a lot. But nonetheless, it was a Republican slogan. It didn't become popularized until Woodrow Wilson used it in 1915. And so people today talk a lot about it as a phrase that was used to keep us out of the Second World War, as you said, you know, in the 30s and in 1940, 41 in particular. But actually, it became popular as a way to talk about keeping us out of the First World War. So although Wilson didn't use it quite in this sense, but it rapidly got taken up in the name of kind of pure isolationism. Let Europe solve their own problems. It's not our issue. So we need to put America first and think about our domestic problems. And it became associated very quickly with protectionist tariffs and indeed with the debates about whether America should join the League of Nations. A lot of people were very suspicious. A lot of Americans were suspicious that the Treaty of Versailles would entangle us in kind of European conflicts in perpetuity, and they argued strenuously that we needed to put America first and not be kind of the foot soldiers of European conflicts going forward. And so that was, you know, the argument that kept us out of the League of Nations. And then Warren Harding ran on America First in 1920. And tried to pass a permanent protectionist tariff, which is a little forgotten bit of history. I think people don't realize. I mean, he wanted to pass that in perpetuity so that we would always have a protectionist tariff. The Teapot Dome scandal put an end to that. And then in 1924, Calvin Coolidge, who also ran on an America First slogan. So, I mean, it was incredibly popular and ubiquitous. It's a really prominent part of the political conversation in the 20s. And Calvin Coolidge passed a sweeping immigration, or rather signed into law, a sweeping immigration reform act in 1924 called the National Origins Act, which is a pretty notorious immigration law that had enacted really strict quotas, really ruthless quotas, on the basis of people's ethnicity and their nations of origin. And it's a pretty clearly eugenicist law, trying to keep immigrant populations from Northern Europe and to ruthlessly restrict them from other parts of the world. And that law was debated on the floor of Congress in the name of America First, and it was passed in the name of America First. So the kinds of political ideas that we now associate with the Trump administration have a much older history. I think as important as that is, though, the more important part is the part that's been lost to sight, which is not only that America First was a very popular slogan with the renascent Ku Klux Klan at that time, and they would, you know, they marched repeatedly with banners saying that they were for America First, they, you know, with parades and what have you. They also took out advertisements saying that they were America's, you know, only society that was for America First. And they were very explicitly in the 1920s, you know, they didn't make any bones about the fact that they were a white supremacist organization.
And we'll pick up on that point in just a few moments. Sarah Churchwell is with us, author of the new book, Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the history of the phrases, the American Dream and America First? And what do those mean to you? Have you seen them change over the years? When you hear America First in 2018, what do you think of? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Sarah Churchwell, professor at the University of London, talking about the evolution of the phrases America First and the American Dream. And Sarah, I want to pick up where we left off there. You were talking about how America First wasn't just a foreign policy concept or a trade protectionist concept. It got tangled up with ideas of who is and isn't an American, who is and isn't 100% American. Pick up there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was used as a code, right? So it's a slightly complicated thing to try to unpick quickly. But basically, they used 100% American pretty much the way that today some people might use real American, right? Where if you press the point and you say, well, what do you mean by a real American? Like, who's an unreal American, or who's a fake American, or what do you really mean? Do you mean somebody who's pretending to be American? And of course what some people, at least, or many people, often mean by that is not a recently naturalized American, not somebody who appears to be alien, not somebody with a funny name, quote unquote, or a strange accent. And indeed, the thing though about 100% that's so important is that it was picking up on the older ideas of the one drop rule, right? So the rule that said that, you know, what they call Negroes, right, that to be legally a Negro and therefore legally subject to slavery, that one drop of Negro blood made you legally a Negro, but you had to have 100% of Anglo-Saxon blood to have all the rights of an Anglo-Saxon. And of course, as we all know, in the 19th century, that meant, you know, being a fully white American and being able to vote and be, you know, fully free and fully enfranchised. And so the idea to say I'm 100% American in that context has a very strong coded implication that you're 100% a citizen. And of course, going back into the Constitution, the Three-Fifths Compromise, right, the Three-Fifths Clause saying that black people were three-fifths of a human being, that slaves were three-fifths. So we have this history of measuring citizenship and humanity in percentages and fractions and saying that some people were not fully human, fully American, fully citizen. And the idea of being 100% American very clearly was picking up on those very old codes. And so the KKK would often, particularly in the 20s, put the two together and they would say, we are 100% American for America first. And those were the kinds of, in fact, they tried to copyright those phrases at one point, and they, you know, they would take out ads saying we're the only 100% American organization that is for America first, and then the next thing they would say is we're also for white supremacy, right? So those ideas were very clearly juxtaposed and linked in the ways that they were, you know, that they were using them and that they were gaining followers with those ideas.
And you cite the case of a long-time public servant, I think a U.S. senator, who was an immigrant to the United States, who was acclaimed as 100% American, but he was Scandinavian. So we were selective about which immigrants even could be 100% American.
Indeed. In fact, he was Norwegian, right? And this was yet another code. So they used this, the idea of being Nordic was a kind of shorthand for this notion of being Northern European, 100% American, Anglo-Saxon, Caucasian, any of those kinds of ideas. And they used them as very synonymously with the way that Hitler would use the word Aryan, right? So that, you know, Aryan in practice could mean any of those things I just said, right? It might mean Caucasian or vaguely Anglo-Saxon, or it might just mean white, or it might just mean light-skinned, or it might mean blue-eyed, or, you know, they could use it kind of in these very elastic ways. And not because, and of course, Aryan is a made-up nation, right? Where with Nordic, they would try to show that they had Northern European heritage. So it's this eugenicist ideal that people were trying to claim. But once you make it as specific as Nordic or Norwegian, it starts to get really confusing because then it's like, do I have to be from Norway for this to apply? And then they'd be like, well, I'm English, but I'm Nordic. And you're like, well, no, but you're not Nordic, you're English. So the whole thing would start to get really tangled. It's almost comical. It would be funny if what was at stake wasn't so terrible. And if we weren't talking about really serious race-based violence at the same time. I mean, this is, of course, the era of really terrible public lynchings in the name of all of this. So, you know, the mix-ups in the language seem farcical, but their consequences were anything but. And the other thing that I found at the time that seems to me really important in this context is that at the same time that the Klan was on the rise and that we were using phrases like America first in the early 1920s is, of course, when European fascism was on the rise. And I'm not speaking here of Hitler, but rather of Mussolini, who, of course, is the one who coined the modern use of fascism as a word. And what you find is that in that time period, all across the country, as newspapers were explaining to their readers what this new concept fascism in Europe was, in Italy was, they would say, well, what Mussolini is doing is basically what the Klan is doing, but in Italy, he stands for America first. Or the way we stand for America first, he stands for Italy first. And if you wanted to know what the new thing, the Klan, was, they would explain that in terms of Mussolini. But if you want to know what this KKK thing is, it's basically what Mussolini is doing, but we call it America first. And so they used these ideas synonymously over and over and over again. And I think that's really important because now we're having debates about whether comparisons with the 20s and 30s are legitimate or whether we're being anachronistic and, you know, kind of superimposing our, you know, current concerns back onto the history of the 1920s and 1930s. But it's actually the other way around. They made the comparison from the get-go. They thought clearly, and they said the KKK is homegrown fascism. It's the same thing. And they totally recognized it. Now, of course, they didn't know how bad European fascism was going to prove to be, but they could see that they were the same movement. And I think that, you know, I certainly never studied homegrown, I mean, I grew up in Chicago, but I never studied homegrown fascism when I was growing up. But, you know, that was something that happened in Europe. It was not something that we said happened in the United States. And I learned about the KKK, but not in relationship to fascism.
Sarah, I want to jump ahead because we just have a couple minutes left. Yeah. I'm going to skip some of the history you talk about. When you look at the phrase America first from the vantage point of 2018 and you hear it said, what do you think it says to the people of America when this is a phrase that's used now?
Well, look, I mean, we can't make generalizations about 325 million people as much as we might want, right? So different people are going to hear different things. And lots of people, of course, are using it innocently in a kind of, you know, a perfectly sensible, you know, basically patriotic way, but without realizing that it has this very dark history that they might not want to be invoking. But some people are using it very consciously and very clearly, and there's a lot of evidence of that. If you go on to neo-Nazi websites like Stormfront and Daily Stormer, you will find them talking about America first in explicitly these terms. And the KKK kept that phrase as one of their slogans through the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And of course, when David Duke endorsed Trump, he said, he stands for what I've always stood for. He stands for America first. So it remains a slogan that the KKK and other alt-right neo-Nazi organizations want to hang on to and that they believe in. And it's important that we recognize that those meanings are there, even when some people don't realize that that's why they're using them. That's why we call them a dog whistle.
And briefly, is getting back to the American dream now, do you see a chance to flip it back around to what it originally meant?
Well, I would love for that to happen, right? Because certainly we're having the same debates, as I said. People are arguing for the importance of, you know, restoring ideas about social justice, about collective well-being, about equality of opportunity, about saying that opportunity should be for the many and not just for the few. And to recognize that we could actually say, and you know what, that was the original American dream. And here's the proof that it was the original American dream and that we've lost sight of aspects of the American dream. I personally find that, you know, really liberating and inspiring. And, you know, it makes me feel a lot more optimistic.
We'll leave it there. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sarah Churchwell, professor of literature and public understanding of the humanities at the University of London. She's been talking with us about her new book. It's called Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.